You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Market-moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC Squawk on the Street. Good Thursday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber and Melissa Lee. Cramer has the morning off. Coming off Dow 29K, first time since February. And while some of the mega cap tech names are down pre-market, they did get bought on the dip yesterday. We'll see if that pattern repeats. Jobless claims come in a bit better than expected when oil is below 41. Our roadmap begins with that breather on Wall Street. Futures indicate a pause for stocks, but is another late surge ahead.
A delayed launch, rocket companies sinking after reporting its first results as a public company. The CEO is going to join us in just a few minutes to discuss.
And later, CEA Chair Tyler Goodspeed as jobless claims come in under consensus and post a new low since the start of that pandemic.
A lot to work with today, David and Melissa, as we watch that intraday period yesterday where we saw Tesla down 10%, for example, worst day for a moment there since early May, David. And then the buyers came in, and we'll see once again if that happens with some of those names like Tesla down about 6% before the bell.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm glad we have Melissa with us today for so many reasons, but one of them is because there's nobody who knows more about this company or certainly has talked about it as much as you guys have on Fast, Melissa, for obvious reasons, as it has soared ever higher over these last few years. And, of course, these last few months have been truly extraordinary. Mm-hmm. We keep making these comparisons to the late 90s, which we all know well. And remember that period well. And Mike Santoli was just doing it also. You know, Tesla is the name, Melissa, that so many people come back to sort of as a sign of the speculation in the market, just given the incredible numbers, whether it's 1,200 times earnings or 73 times revenues, although it's a bit lower than that now, given yesterday's pullback, and only 367,000 vehicles delivered over the last year. But here we are.
Here we are. I mean, it certainly is a symbol of that notion of buying into future growth, especially when interest rates are so low. And I think that's critical. I mean, when you make that comparison to the 90s, interest rates were nowhere near where they are today. And so those interest rates that we see today, you know, with the 10-year sub 0.7% at this point, that enables these markets to levitate higher and have higher PEs. That said, specifically for Tesla, obviously it's in a sector that has had a lot of speculative enthusiasm, shall we say, when you take a look at how NIO has done, how Nikola has done, Plug Power, Workhorse, all of these names, which, by the way, are also favorites among the Robinhood investors. They've all seen this sort of lift to all boats on the back of the enthusiasm for Tesla. When you hear Bailey Gifford, the largest Tesla shareholder, aside from Elon Musk, yep, saying that it's going to cut its stake, and even if it's simply to rebalance its portfolio because of Tesla's magnificent run, and it's a huge percentage of their portfolio now, they had to trim it back. That sort of underscores this notion that, hey, this run is all the way up here. Maybe it's time for some prudent portfolio management at this point. Carl.
Indeed. I mean, and we're looking for signs of rotation, Melissa. Interesting, mm-hmm, to see some of the large growth ETFs, the Vanguard, the VUG, the iShares Core S&P Growth, seeing their biggest outflows, David, on record for the month. And we're starting to monitor whether flows mean anything at this point for overall value. But to Melissa's point about Robinhood traders and the interest in EVs, well, I mean, I'm sure at some point today we'll talk about QuantumScape, this Bill Gates-backed battery SPAC, which would be the first or the latest SPAC deal in autos since Nikola back in June.
Yeah, we will. Phil LeBeau earlier, I was listening closely to his reporting on that because, as Melissa says, these have become a so-called favorite of what is this growing cohort, or one that has certainly grown substantially over the last few months, of individual investors. back in this market and reminiscent again of the late 90s in that way, given their the significant participation, of course, of so many people who otherwise had not really known that much about the stock market and may not have actually known that much about the stock market when they were investing in it. But Robinhood Platform or E-Trade or Schwab and Ameritrade have seen enormous growth. We have talked about various names that have benefited greatly from them. And as you point out, Carl, this area in particular, EV, and Melissa went through a lot of the names, have seen that. You know, Melissa, you can't blame, you talked about the largest shareholder there, obviously. You can't blame them for their asset allocation decisions there. No. I mean, my God, what a great investment that's been for them. I'd point out, obviously, Musk, whose net worth was almost $115 billion a couple of days ago as a result of an $87 billion increase just this year. And Larry Ellison, don't forget. I mean, the rich get richer here, don't they? Larry Ellison made an incredible investment not that many years ago in Tesla as well, if you recall. And he has benefited greatly from that also. Just kind of trying to go through the various people and investors who benefited from this incredible run.
Yeah, Kathy Wood over at ARK Invest. And some of these investors have come under scrutiny because they have trimmed their positions. But again, it's because of portfolio management. It's because of the run that Tesla has had. They can't allow one single position in their portfolio to exceed a certain percent. And so by mandate, they've got to do that. The question here is, as we start to see undercurrents of a rotation, we saw that yesterday, and we've seen this in fits and starts over time. It hasn't really taken hold per se as a lasting trend because we've always seen investors come back and bid up tech shares higher. But in yesterday's session, as we hit those record highs, it wasn't tech leading the charge. And Carl, you had mentioned Tesla paring its losses yesterday. It pared its losses but still finished the day down pretty sharply. It was a Russell 1000 value index that was up 1.4% in yesterday's session. We saw utilities and financials do really well. And so the question here, as we sit here pre-market and see these big cap tech stocks like an Apple, a Microsoft trade lower. All the chip stocks are under pressure this morning because of the reports that China is going to do more to foster its domestic chip industry. We have to wonder whether or not we'll continue to see that rotation, especially as we head into the election.
That's true. Whether or not that rotation means that banks and yields do better, we'll talk more about the Deutsche upgrade today of J.P. Morgan and Bank of America, guys. But Facebook's the other big story. For the first time, limiting new political ads beginning the week before the election. Mark Zuckerberg saying the company's starting to plan for the possibility of a presidential contender either declaring victory or declaring the election count somehow rigged. He was on CBS this morning talking about just to whom those restrictions might apply. Take a listen.
I certainly think that anyone who's saying that the election is going to be fraudulent, I think that's problematic. And I think additional context needs to be added to that.
It's not just anyone. It's not just a regular Joe. It's a president of the United States. Yes.
This will definitely apply to the president once this policy goes into place, and it will apply to everyone equally.
So an interesting evolution, you could argue, David, in Zuckerberg and Facebook's thinking about the legitimacy of advertising, especially leading up to the hours where people actually go to the polls. Doesn't mean you can't run an ad at all, just can't institute a new ad 1 week prior to the vote.
It is going to be, it would seem, a very crucial period. We all know at this point the importance that the Facebook platform plays in terms of dissemination of information and conceivably helping people make decisions around things like which candidate they support. And we all can look back at the 2016 election for evidence of that. You know, it's been an evolution on the part of Mr. Zuckerberg to a certain extent. He gets criticized from the right for not allowing enough conservative voices. He gets criticized for the left for empowering the right. He's in a difficult position, Melissa, but it is interesting to note that they've made this decision. Twitter has thus far been much more aggressive, it would seem, about policing things like inaccurate tweets, even from the president. But clearly from that interview and that interchange there, it seems that they will be willing to not allow the president to make false claims on the platform, at least during that period of time, when they say they can't be rebutted effectively by the other side.
I think if you're being criticized on both sides, you're doing something right. I mean, we feel that all the time on our end, right, David? When you talk, I mean, literally minutes, seconds after we had that Tesla conversation, I got a tweet saying I've been on the wrong side of this trade for a long time, and I've been totally against it. And on the other hand, I got another tweet saying that I've always been pushing it. I mean, it's when you're getting criticism from both sides, that means that you're not favoring either, and that's something good. For Facebook, especially Facebook had been slow to the game in terms of responding. Twitter had been sort of at the forefront of being the arbiter of truth, so to speak. Facebook didn't want to be the arbiter of truth. So for it to step in here and make this announcement, I think has really shown you how far the company has come in thinking in terms of how to deal with these issues, especially an issue that had completely roiled them. The last election. They have to be proactive this time around.
Yeah, we had Dick Costolo of Twitter on the Squawk Alley yesterday, guys, and he argued that for platforms including Twitter and Facebook, that the degree to which they remove, for example, deep fakes or doctored videos, these companies are going to have to become, in his words, overzealous about removing them, and that may mean that some accounts are removed that don't deserve to be. But as Dick said, David, people are going to have to get over that because the underreaction is simply not working right now.
Yeah, and we've talked over some time about how many people Facebook has added in terms of to their ranks to try to at least do something to police the site. There are still, as Melissa points out, plenty of critics out there who say it is far from enough on the part of the company in terms of its role here. It obviously says, hey, free speech. You know, we're not going to sit here and police everything. People have a right to express their thoughts and their feelings. So it's still a gray area to some extent. I would assume they're bulking up even more for this period that we're entering now, a couple of months before the election. The prospect, perhaps, as you've pointed out, Carl, and many others have as well, of mail-in voting delaying the results to the extent that we will not know who the winner is. So it's going to be quite a period here that we're entering into, I think it's fair to say, Carl. And of course, we've talked about the impact as well on the stock market.
Which we'll talk a lot about more. 61 days, of course, until the vote and early voting really getting started in the next few days. So much news to get to, guys. We'll talk about Rocket and their first quarter as a public company, the upgrade of J.P. Morgan and Bank of America out of Deutsche, upgrade of FedEx. There's PVH, CrowdStrike, and a lot more. Don't go away.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Shares of the Quicken Loans parent Rocket Companies are down sharply, you can see over 10% this morning. This after reporting its first results as a public company. Rocket Company CEO Jay Farner joins us now. And Jay, I have to say, in my experience, seeing a newly public company print $3.5 billion in net income is rare to say the least. Nonetheless, at least at this point, investors don't seem particularly taken with it. Any idea in your part as to why the stock is looking down 10%?
Well, thanks for having me this morning. And I'll tell you, our focus has really been where the stock price has gone since the IPO here just a few short weeks ago. So we're up pretty substantially. And Q2 was a great quarter. And Q3, we think, will be even better. So, you can probably help me understand the day-to-day trading of the stock better than I can help you. But the long term is where we'll continue to stay focused on.
I know you are. And to your point, the stock did perform extremely well right after the IPO and the sort of those days and weeks following. And it may simply be the weakness is based on how much strength there's been to date. Again, because you point out your volumes were enormous, they're going to stay there. I mean, how long can we expect, Jay, to have a mortgage market like the one we're in right now, which we report on every day in terms of housing being so hot?
Yeah, great question. You know, as we talked about the third quarter, were our expectations that we'll see continued growth. You know, we're hearing that we're going to see interest rates low for quite some time. And when we think about demand right now, the demand for refinancing and purchase, third quarter will probably be one of the best quarters we've had, remains strong. So really our mission right now is to continue to grow capacity. We're up to over 100,000 clients closed in a month, and our goal is to get to $40 billion a month closed by the end of the year. So the future looks very bright, and for us it's about that platform, about growing out that technology and continuing to take care of our clients with world-class service.
You're certainly optimistic, Jay, but in terms of your commentary suggesting that volumes may follow a more seasonal pattern, that there may be some seasonality, which is typically weaker in fiscal fourth quarter, how much of that is just being conservative, considering the high volumes that we've had, and maybe your expectation that there is some pull forward of housing plus the seasonality factor?
Well, actually, I think that the purchase is going to be remaining stronger through the end of this year. We've seen that so far, and we're looking for inventory to increase a bit. And I think our comments were really more reflective of the natural cycles that we see year in and year out, especially between Christmas and New Year. But as you know, with interest rates the way they are today and the 30-year fixed in the threes, people will be refinancing their homes regardless of the time of the year. And that's going to mean for a great third quarter and a strong finish to the year.
Speaking of which, Jay, I wonder, there's a view on the street among some who are watching the banks that the bulk of loss reserves for the year is either close to being over or may already be over if you are convinced that macro strength is returning. You got any color on that?
No, I don't have a lot of color on how the banks are performing from a loss perspective or their reserves. I can tell you from our perspective, we watch forbearances very closely, of course, as one of the largest servicers in the country. And we're actually seeing our forbearance rate continue to drop, which I think is great news. I saw you reporting jobless claims as well. So I think overall, a real positive feeling that banks, companies are positioned well, and there's a lot of bright side or upside that we're going to experience as we get into the second half of this year.
How have your lending standards been, Jay, compared to, say, 6 months ago or a year ago? And I'm wondering if there's any sort of opacity in the amount of data that you have. What struck me was that there was a comment about a month ago from the Capital One Financial CEO saying that they don't have a really rigorous handle on the level of unemployment amongst their borrowers, that it's just unclear that many people are at certain levels of unemployment. You mentioned forbearances. Forbearances don't get reflected in credit score. So I'm wondering how you adjust for these things that may not have existed before.
Yeah, great question. So the lending standards are the same as they've been. In fact, in a few areas, a bit tighter than they were 6 months ago. And so we feel great about the credit quality that we're seeing, the income quality, and the loan-to-value on mortgages as we've seen property values continue to increase. And as I mentioned, from a forbearance perspective, I think this reflects the servicing approach that we take, proactively reaching out to our clients, ensuring that there's somebody there to pick up the telephone, take their call or their email. And in talking with our clients, our book looks in some very good shape. So I think with the credit, that the criteria that's being used today, you know, the mortgage industry is in a nice spot right now.
You also, Jay, have put out a longer-term target, 25% market share by 2030. Why share something like that with investors?
You know, I think it's important to talk about where we're headed long-term, because in this business, the day or the week or even the quarter can be hard to predict. And so when we think about our strategic focus, we think about what we're going to be working on for the next year, the next 3 years, the next 5 years, the next 10 years. That sets our strategy, the tech that we're going to build, the marketing that we're going to be doing, the client experience that we're going to be generating, how we grow our real estate business, our auto business. All of those things are kind of long-term strategic plans. And so giving that target of 25%, I think helps investors think about what they can expect from the company over the long haul, which is a better way, at least for us in the last 35 years that we've been in business, a better way to focus on it than looking at it day to day or week to week.
Yeah. And finally, Jay, back to the current environment. I noted that on the call you said 98% of your team is working from home still.
Yeah.
When do you expect people to get back to the office?
Well, we've told our team members that they can expect to work from home through the remainder of this year. I think giving them certainty, especially with folks having children entering school and those type of things, is really important. We're hopeful that we'll be bringing back a significant portion of our team members as we start 2021. And I think the really exciting thing and the thing that helped us as you look at our Q2 numbers is that our ability to get that 98% from the office to the home in less than a few days allowed us to have a record March, which then we followed up, of course, with in April and May and have continued to do so. So that platform that we've built, allowing our team members to work anywhere remotely, has really benefited us through this process. And the great news is, even as hopefully we see the pandemic solve for in the coming months, that work from home option now will give us flexibility that we didn't have before.
Right, but not necessarily good news for even a Detroit, which, of course, you and your founder as well have been so focused on helping to build up. I mean, these urban areas, you know, when I hear a company like yours say, oh, we could keep having people work remotely for a long period of time because we're not losing productivity, is that a bad signal for Detroit or New York or any of these other places?
Yeah, I got to say for Detroit, I don't believe so. And here's why. People want to come to the city. The demand from our team members to say, hey, I want to be back in the office. More importantly, I'm going to be back in the city, experiencing the city, is strong. And so the office will look different when folks return, and we'll probably have more collaborative space. But people are itching to get back here to the city, experience the city. And so it'll be different. I believe we can make it better. And so kind of have the best of both worlds, giving people more flexibility from a work perspective, but also enjoying the city, and that'll be helping propel the long-term growth of Detroit and other places across the country.
All right, amen. Jay Farner, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Take a break here. Get to all of the vaccine, therapeutics, and testing news that we've gotten this week, including some new headlines this morning from Pfizer. And we'll dig into jobless claims, as we said, a bit better than expected. What does that mean for the jobs number tomorrow? Futures are weak. We're back in a minute.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Take a look at shares of Carnival on the move pre-market after the company announced that its Italy-based Costa Cruises will resume operations this weekend, followed by one of its German-based brands in early November. The trips will have limited itineraries and adjusted passenger capacity, along with advanced health protocols. That stock is up 4.6% ahead of the open. We should note that NCLH, RCL, the other cruise lines, they are up also sharply pre-market. Don't go anywhere. Squawk on the Street. Be right back.
Futures are weak on this Thursday morning, but some of the names that are going to be up at the open have a thread of retail running through them. Costco's a good example as August comps come in right around 13%. We were looking for something just north of 10. That's a bit of an impressive move out of Costco. PVH, although sales obviously were hindered greatly by store closures, did manage to turn out a better than expected bottom line. That's going to open slightly in the green, about 1%. And then, Melissa, FedEx, as all these kids are going back to school, we're watching for the consumer's ability to continue to spend into the fall. Berenberg says we're going to start to see a split between the UPSs and the FedExes of the world. They take FedEx to buy, and as we know, the fall is going to come with a lot of shipping surcharges. that the bulls are going to argue could bolster some of those shipping companies' bottom lines.
Yeah, and we've seen that run when they announced the pricing increases that are akin to holiday price increases, but earlier in the year. And so we've seen them sort of benefit from that announcement prior. Going back to Costco, I thought this was an interesting quarter because the growth there for Costco was really international. It was the UK. It was Korea. It was in those markets outside the United States. It was the ticket size, so each basket was bigger for Costco. But what was key was that the biggest category for Costco, which is food, that seemed to be moderating. And that sort of suggests that perhaps comps are going to be tougher going forward.
And we already know what food prices have done in the past few weeks. Eggs, lunch meat, you name it. So we look at inflation, ex-food and energy, but anybody who goes to the grocery store lately knows exactly what the deal is. There's the opening bell and a good look at breadth this morning as we pay attention to some of these overall levels. 35.59. Melissa, I see that Savita over at B of A raises her target, but a pretty wide range of outcomes between the bull case and the bear case. Over 10 years, though, as she looks at valuation trends, 5,200 S&P in 10 years out of B of A today. Pretty interesting note.
In 10 years, Carl, we can come back and have Savita on and see if she was right and interview her about how she got to that 52. Yeah, exactly. In 10 years, we'll learn. I love when analysts do some of these long-term projections because even a year seems like an impossibility to actually forecast, especially in a year like this, David.
Yeah, I don't know how any of them do it. And a lot of them are unfortunately having to do backflips in terms of their price targets. Yep. I'm sure you saw the Peloton price target today that was raised by, I don't even remember who, but I mean, numbers that you could never even have imagined, to your point, Melissa, as little as a few weeks ago, let alone a year ago, as we watch Peloton shares actually down a bit this morning. We're starting to see a little bit of rotation, Melissa, out of these huge momentum names that we've seen, of course, led by Apple right now, at least on a market cap basis, which opened the morning, let's call it, down a little over 2% after being lower yesterday and is now only up a mere 74.7% for the year. But its market value has fallen below $2.2 trillion. Of course, 2 days ago, it was above $2.3 trillion. Not sure where it's cycling to. And, you know, Melissa, these moves have been so short-lived in terms of what appears to be at least some rotation in the market that then never really fully rotates in any way.
Yeah, there's so many calls for, oh, the start of the value rotation, right? And then just as quickly as you can get the words out of our mouths, or investors can get the words out of their mouths, it's over. And we see investors come back in and go to the old playbook of growth stocks, of technology stocks, of bidding Apple to over $2 trillion in market cap. But it is worth noting here today that we are seeing strength in the financials. So this is follow through from yesterday. And we do have the Deutsche Bank upgrading JP Morgan as well as the Bank of America to a buy rating. We're seeing a little bit of a steepening of the yield curve. And this notion, guys, and JP Morgan put this out earlier this week. We had Mark Kalanovic, the strategist at JP Morgan on Fast Money, outlining why he thinks there could be a value rotation underway, especially as the election comes. And if Donald Trump wins, and this is not meant to be a political conversation, but simply just a strategy conversation, that there will be this very strong rotation into value and that investors could get caught a little flat-footed unless they start rotating ahead of that. So this is worth watching to see if this actually holds. Yesterday, as we mentioned, utilities and financials were the leadership groups in the markets. We'll see if that works again today.
Yeah, I saw the president mention the Kalanovic note on the tarmac the other day, although he said it was Morgan Stanley, which obviously, I don't know if Marco minds, but it definitely was J.P. Morgan with that call about the trends tightening for a Trump win and investors potentially being out of position. But guys, the leaders this morning, we mentioned PVH and Melissa mentioned Carnival, but a lot of travel, a lot of leisure. Delta, the airlines are doing fairly well. I wonder, David, if this is sort of putting the cap on the week we've had when we're getting news about a very quick Abbott test and the Roche test and a Glaxo trial and Novavax last night and the FDA telling cities and states to start planning for distribution to healthcare workers in late October or early November, which of course was the big news last night.
Yeah, I mean, that emergency usage, though, has gotten a lot of people's attention potentially, and at least some medical professionals certainly voicing their concerns from what I've been able to read about the idea that any vaccine, Carl, would be approved in that way as opposed to going through the full phase three trials and receiving the rigor of the FDA and then being out there in the market, which could conceivably, according to Dr. Fauci, still be as soon as perhaps by the end of this year. So not that many months, but, you know, emergency usage would potentially be pointing to an earlier use. And again, let's not forget, particularly the mRNA candidates, mm-hmm. when we're talking about Moderna, a few others. Melissa, these results that we've seen, quite positive, are on an extraordinarily low population. And when you move into vaccinating tens of millions of people, the last thing, of course, that you want to do is get anyone sick who wasn't sick to begin with. And so, you know, you do have to wonder where this comes out and whether or not they will be allowed to just fully move through phase three and therefore perhaps gain more confidence in the population at large that the that whatever vaccine we get, or sure, hopefully a few of them, are safe and effective.
But the calendar really works in the favor of this notion that there will be some sort of emergency use vaccine soon. The FDA has a very important virus vaccine meeting scheduled for October 22nd. Moderna this morning announced its virtual R&D day, which is going to take place on September 17th. There is a great expectation that there will be interim results, at least from Moderna and the Pfizer and BioNTech candidates, sometime in the next month and a half or so. And if you read that New York Times article, the New York Times had that article about the CDC advising local governments to get ready. They are saying that if you take a look at the specifications that the CDC had mentioned, that it does sort of, if you connect the dots, it draws a line to Moderna as well as Pfizer and BioNTech as being the vaccine A and vaccine B that were mentioned in the memos given to states. So we are seeing Moderna shares, for instance, trade higher by more than 3%, 3.6% in today's session. Pfizer not getting too much of a bid, but we did see that big run in Pfizer prior on the news of its vaccine. So maybe not entirely a surprise there.
Yeah, we'll watch that. Obviously, there's lots of things that you could potentially see reopen if a vaccine were approved and, as David says, widely accepted by the public. AMC is going to be opening, as we know, 70% of theaters this weekend. A couple actually in New Jersey getting announced today. But David, I guess it's the secondary that's weighing on the shares down about 2%. But there's that to watch. And then there's also, you know, we've got Tenet already playing. And now we got a trailer this morning for No Time to Die, the latest James Bond. And The Hollywood Reporter does a pretty nice piece about what they call the studio marketing machine roaring back to life, in their words, which would be welcome news to a lot of those in the media business.
It certainly would. Yeah, and to your point, of course, about AMC, we're talking about, 30 million shares of common stock that the company did issue at this point. Adam Aron's still sounding quite positive about the future potentially for that company. Carl, when it comes to production, of course, let's not forget about TV. Interesting journal story today in terms of advertisers looking for the ability to cancel a larger percentage of what they've committed to if, for example, the NFL doesn't succeed in pulling off a season or more college football falls by the wayside. Not to mention what, Melissa, is going to be a very slim offering of new shows mm-hmm. in the fall here for all of the major television networks and cable networks at this point, given the inability to really produce over the course of the last 6 months, and they're just getting back to it now. So, yeah, maybe we'll get a couple of movies, but we don't expect any sort of outpouring here of video content anytime soon.
And that's a problem not just for the networks, obviously, in terms of the ad dollars, but also for all the streaming services, which have so benefited from the pandemic. You're sitting at home and you've gone through Netflix's library and you're thinking, what's going to come next? We don't know what's going to come next, really. There has been such a production halt in Hollywood that, you know, the slate of new shows that were expected may not actually come. And you have to wonder whether or not that's going to hit the numbers for all these subscriptions.
Yeah, well, we could all use some fresh stuff to watch. Guys, Tesla down 5%. And as Bespoke says today, it's only been down 4% on back-to-back-to-back days three times in its history. So we'll watch that. In the meantime, let's get to some of the other movers with our Bob Pisani today. Hey, Bob.
Hello, guys. Happy Thursday. And finally, a breather. This is a welcome respite. Believe me, a lot of frothiness. Frothy stocks down today, moving into some other sectors. Let's just take a look at what's moving here. You got banks up today, so you got a lot of the regional banks moving modestly on the upside. Industrials are holding in there. Healthcare is flattish. Energy flattish as well. And, of course, semiconductors notably weak. A lot of concerns. Melissa was mentioning on issues in China, and maybe they're helping to develop their own internal semiconductor industry. That's a very legitimate concern and a very legitimate fear. I like the fact that we're seeing a lot of the frothy stocks. I mentioned yesterday stocks where RSIs were over 80, names like Apple or Nvidia or Zoom Video or Salesforce or Tesla or CrowdStrike here. These stocks were ridiculously frothy, and today they're all down 2, 3, 4, even 5%. That's a good sign. That naturally should happen when you get in this kind of overbought territory. You can't go up every single day for weeks on end. It just doesn't happen, and today you're seeing a bit of a correction. Upside movers, the travel and leisure is doing better. Obviously, the vaccine and the treatment story is helping. PVH was good numbers. Leisure wear sales are up. No surprise there. And you see some of the regional banks like Zions on the upside. A lot of talk about the increase in options activity out there and futures activity. There has been an increase in call buying, but this is very natural and understandable. Equity futures, look here at the CME, up 64% year-to-date compared to last year. Equity options at the CBOE up almost 50%. Why? Well, there's some more retail buying out there, but remember, we've had a rally going on that's pretty notable for a while now, and there's a cause and effect here. The cause of the rally has been negative real rates. The Fed liquidity and an improving economy, slowly improving economy. That has an interesting effect. The market's going up and there are people at the upper end who are engaging in more call option activity, a lot of call buying, particularly deep out of the money call buying. So that, remember the cause and effect here. The cause is the market going up. The effect is some people out there engaging in more option activity. And some of that option activity may be contributing to some of that frothiness. But just don't confuse the cause and effect. Another thing I'm getting a lot of calls on the last couple days, IPO traders, boy, they're expecting a mountain of stuff coming, and they're very excited about it, and they should be. You wouldn't have believed this 3 months ago, but the IPO business is doing great. Year-to-date, 111 companies, $37 billion been raised. Go back to 2014. This was the Alibaba year. They raised $85 billion back then. We have a shot at getting close to the best year since 2014, and that was Alibaba was a good part of all of that. Really kind of remarkable comeback for the IPO business. And the reason, of course, that's happening, you got the big three things going on here. First, you got a market rally going on. From the bottom, the S&P is up 60% from the March 23rd bottom. But the IPO market has been on fire. From the bottom, the IPO market's up 135%. The IPO ETF is up 60% this year. So it's outperforming the overall market. There's your two factors. And then you've got the whole work from home business. This has been a boon for the enterprise software companies. And guess who's coming public? Most of them are enterprise software companies to take advantage of this whole, the fact that everybody needs to upgrade their systems. The retail companies, the banks, the doctor's offices, everybody needs to do that. If you look at the recent IPO prices, some of these companies, Vroom and Rocket Companies and Lee Auto even, electric vehicles, Jamf, which is a Apple platform manager, these have been great, all tied to the tech IPOs. What's coming in the next couple of weeks? Look at this, Snowflake, Unity Software, GoodRx, JFrog Holdings here, which is a software update platform. Sumo Logic does data analysis. Folks, it's all software. Enterprise software is eating the world, and you're going to see a lot more about these companies in the next couple of weeks. Guys, back to you.
All right, Bob, we'll talk to you in a little while. Our Bob Pisani. I'll take a break here. Is a rotation in place? We'll find out. The banks are up almost 1.5%. Yields not necessarily ratifying that move. This is the biggest drop at the moment for the S&P and NASDAQ since August 11th. Back in a minute. Busy morning for eco data, and there's more on the way. Let's get to Rick Santelli. Hey, Rick.
Yes, this is the first of some PMIs. This is the market services PMI. It's an August final. Final means we have a mid-month read, which was 54.8. That gets tossed. It's now replaced with 55.0. 55.0 is the number. That's the best read on this indice since March of 2019. We'll call it, what, 17, 18 months? And if we look at the composite figure, the 54.7 there gets replaced with 54.6, basically a lateral move, but nonetheless solid. and ISM Services, the PMI coming out in about 15 minutes. And that, of course, a more seasoned read. That goes back to 97. Markets go back to, well, they celebrated their three-year birthday in August. Carl, back to you.
All right, Rick, thank you. We'll see you in a little bit. Rick Santelli. Jobless claims earlier this morning did come in under consensus, 881,000 versus an expected 950,000. That's a new low since the start of the pandemic. The acting chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, Tyler Goodspeed, is with us this morning. Tyler, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Definitely trending in the right direction, although there's a lot of concerns about the methodology with claims, the degree to which census might color the jobs number tomorrow. What's the expectation at the White House?
Well, we were definitely very encouraged by the unemployment insurance claims numbers coming out today. In the continuing claims, we saw 764,000 fewer Americans in insured unemployment for the week ending August 22nd. That was a tremendous number, and it certainly bodes well for the August employment situation report coming out tomorrow.
Is there, you know, we track a lot of high-frequency data, credit card spending, various color that we get from the likes of Visa. And in general, the view has been that August has not been as weak as some had feared, given the expiration of those enhanced unemployment benefits. Does the White House have an explanation as to why that might be true?
Well, for one thing, as we just saw in the unemployment insurance claims numbers, the labor market has been stronger than expected. This was the fifth consecutive week of six-digit declines in continuing claims. And right now, the expectations on the street are for private payroll employment growth of 1.3 million in the month of August. That's certainly going to support consumer spending. And as you said, we saw in retail sales data from the credit cards that actually retail sales are now above their February 2020 levels. And then also an additional level of support for consumer spending was the continuation of enhanced unemployment assistance by the federal government, thanks to executive action by President Trump.
So the takeaway for some, because of those better than expected numbers, is that perhaps there's less urgency to put a compromise together for further aid on the Hill. What's the view on that?
Well, the president absolutely wants bipartisan legislation that he can then sign into law. It was in the absence of that movement on the Hill that he proceeded with executive action. And I would just like to note that of all the people in this town who could have acted to provide a continuation of enhanced unemployment insurance benefits, who could have acted to provide protection and relief for student borrowers and American renters, who could have acted to boost take-home pay for Americans who continue to go into work in the face of present challenges and risks. Of all the people who could have taken action on each of those fronts, only one person in this town actually did that.
Tyler, finally, on trade, the trade deficit, as you know, in July, it's almost $64 billion. It's the highest level in 12 years. Imports were up by a record. The view among some is going to be that the trade war that the president once said was easy to win is just not paying off. Why is that?
So when we look at, we have a different interpretation of the trade numbers coming out today. First and foremost, it shows a recovery in global trade. Exports grew, imports grew by more. The U.S. is still a predominantly services-oriented economy, so we're going to, and services have not been rebounding quite as quickly as goods, so we're going to expect the goods deficit to widen as things recover. But look, when we look at the national and income product accounts data, then what we actually see is that net exports as a share of GDP in the United States have improved in 2017, 2018, 2019, and 2020. Relative to the preceding 8 and 16 years. So as a share of GDP, net exports have actually improved to negative 2.8% during the 3.5 years of the Trump administration. This compares to an average of negative 3.1% during the preceding 8 years and an average of almost negative 4% during the preceding 16 years. But I think our number one read in these trade numbers today is that this is a sign of a rebounding U.S. and indeed global economy.
Mm-hmm. We'll watch that, obviously. Tyler, a lot of numbers to get to, and of course, the big one tomorrow. We appreciate it very much. Good to see you.
Thanks very much.
Melissa.
All right, let's take a look, another look at the NASDAQ here of the major three. This one is really taking the hit, taking a leg lower, down by 1.75%. Its lowest level since July 23rd. We've got a 3% decline in Apple, 2+% declines in Facebook, Microsoft, in the semiconductors. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
Got to watch Tesla today. Found some very quick support again, right around 405. After the open, but both for Tesla and Apple, that is 3 days of declines at the moment. One reason the NASDAQ is having its worst day since July 23rd, even as the Dow closes the gap from its February high to about 1.2%. Back in a moment. Got to mention Robinhood before we close out the hour, facing an SEC probe over not disclosing deals with high-speed traders. That's according to the Journal this morning. Could cost the upstart brokerage firm a fine exceeding $10 million. Between this, Melissa, and a lot of outages over the summer, it has been a tough couple of months for Robinhood.
What they're accused of doing is legal payment for order flow, but it's the notion of not disclosing it clearly prior to 2018, when in actuality it made up a big chunk of its revenues. If they settle, though, they don't have to admit or deny anything, so that could just be a clean way to get past this. In the meantime, we're still continuing to watch the NASDAQ very, very closely. We mentioned this at the top, this rotation that we saw starting in yesterday's session away from technology into some of the more value cyclical areas of the market. We see that continue today. We've got regional banks up strongly. We've got energy up strongly. Energy, by the way, stocks up despite crude oil being lower today on fears of demand softness. We do have the likes of an ExxonMobil, for instance, up by about 2%. And, of course, the reopening trade, David and Carl, the reopening trade is on fire, perhaps on this notion that the CDC is urging states and local governments to get ready to deploy a potential vaccine to frontline workers, to nursing homes, et cetera, by the end of October, early November timeframe. And that really lit a fire in yesterday's session late in the day, and we're seeing that carry over into today's session.
Yeah, something we would have talked about before the pandemic, namely a market driven by quantitatively driven funds and the algorithms that power them, Melissa and Carl, seems to perhaps be in play more today than does the new phenomena that we've talked about so often, which is the power of the retail investor on platforms such as Robinhood. So we'll see how long this lasts, but perhaps the machines have a little bit more control today, Carl.
Yeah. And one last thing, David, before we get to ISM, is this the Juul announcement. You know, we've seen talking about Exxon, Saudi Aramco, and Juul, companies trying to retrench, maybe pull out of certain countries, as the question is asked again today, whether or not Altria's investment in Juul was one of the worst since AOL Time Warner or before.
Well, you know, luckily for them, it wasn't anywhere near the size, though don't get me wrong, if my memory serves, it was over $12 billion. It was a big number, but it is not a good deal for them in any way, shape, or form. I think we can safely say that. Of course, the safety concerns that Juul faced fairly early on after that investment, they never actually even got the approval, remember, from the DOJ to actually take voting control. The whole thing was a nightmare scenario for that company.
Yeah. Although Altria shares are not reflecting the news at the moment. You've been listening to The Opening Bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.